sixth session, and we're on number nine.
We're on number nine. Lee Rossi, can you
Yeah.
believe it? Cleric, is it unbelievable?
Amazing.
And that's our 11th love or die session.
It's been a
Right.
year. It's been a year almost.
Wow. Wow. And Andrew and I were just beginning a conversation on what the next, but we've got two, let's forget about the future. We have two big, huge conversations to have. And so, wow. So we are on, should Andrew, should we just describe where we are? Should we just dive right in?
Sure. So Tree of Life, Yesod, which I understand is the phallus.
Yeah,
So we're
so
going
does
to
it
talk about the
sound.
phallus today, the testicles, the balls, the foundation.
We are,
Do I
right?
have it correct this time,
You do,
or
you've got it, my friend, right?
oh,
And
good.
so let's remember, let's just kind of and I totally of course want to see you, but I'm gonna see if I can do this little magic where I can kind of see everyone at the same time. There's everybody. Yay. What a delight. What a crazy delight. What a crazy delight. So what we actually thought we would do today is Andrew, we thought about this, maybe just collect phallus stories. No, let's not do that. Okay, so let's do our regular process. Okay.
Well, I
Okay.
wanted to ask you, are we going to do Yesod and Malkuth? Are we going to do the
No,
dyad?
just
Or we're
Yesod.
just going to do just do Yesod and we'll do Malkuth
Yesod. Yeah,
next time?
no,
Very good.
it's too big of a deal. It's too big of a deal, right? Lane, good to see you. Right? It's good to see you, right? So yes, ceasefire now, amen. So we're in the tree of life, number one. Let's just kind of we'll just land. Okay, we'll just land everybody, and we're gonna. We said we would last time. We didn't. We've been trying to persuade Andrew to play. So if he's gonna try and avoid it today, he won't be able to avoid it on the last tree of life because we're gonna have him play in the beginning, right?
Exactly. I'm going to avoid it against w once more time, one more time today, but I will do figure
So
something out
our
for
grad, I'm
beginners
gonna make this
for
clear,
sure.
everyone. So. What we're going to do is Andrew's going to then play at the beginning of next time. I'm on strike, right? Until next time, until we
No,
hear.
at the end, at the end, at the end.
No. We then you're going to try and get out of it. We don't believe you, right? We don't trust you anymore, right? So at the beginning, right? So we're kicking off with Andrew next time, right? And if he
Okay.
doesn't play, then we don't talk, which is fine. It's all good. So no coercion or nothing like that, or no subtle, kind of just. But we need because we loved it so much the first time,
Problem is,
Andrew.
I have a ukulele right now. I don't have a guitar, so I have to get used to my new instrument.
I got it. I got it.
That's
I got
my
it.
excuse.
Okay, we could all get Andrew a guitar. I mean, that's also a possibility. Who's in favor of getting Andrew a guitar? Show of hands. Let's just show of hands. I think so. Anybody else? Show of hands. Andrew, everybody wants to have a guitar. Okay, and Kathy's sitting this one out. She's saying, I don't know who should have a guitar. I'm not going to vote. I'm sitting here in New York. I'm not voting. Jane, what did I say? Yes, we got a yes there. Jane, guitar. Does Andrew need a guitar?
If you write, if you get me a guitar, I'll write you a bunch of songs. How about
Whoa!
that?
Okay, now we're up in the stakes here.
You want to up at the stakes?
We're up in the stakes. We're getting songs written if we get a guitar. Okay, now
No.
it's getting interesting. Okay, here we go. Okay, and
Yeah,
I do want
let's go.
just one thing just before we get started. Just if you can, everyone, I know that people have this thing of double tasking, and I totally get that. But if you can, right, try not to double task, A, and B, try and turn on your camera so we can see you. Right. And again, it's part of the malaise of modernity, right? Is this sense of this massive double tasking that everyone does, which causes us to lose something, right? So it kind of causes us to lose a certain kind of intentionality, a certain kind of focus. I'll tell you guys just a funny thing, just a little funny thing, Andrew, and we'll get started. I have one person I'm very close to, D. I'll just call him D, and that we do these long voxes. And I kind of went on strike like a week ago. We had this long, he had left me a long set of boxes, and I just said, you know what? I'm stopping asynchronous talking of a certain kind, right? Because there's something that happens. People, first of all, are in the room and they talk to each other. That's one. Now we're not in the room. So we can actually, there's something we can do very beautifully and find each other on Skype. Right? I know this is not Skype, that dates me, right? Right? On whatever this is called, Zoom. Right. I know we don't have rotary phones. I got it. Right. We're on Zoom. We can kind of find each other, but then people start kind of texting as if like people don't notice. They do whatever they want to do in the right, and then people start talking asynchronous. I'll leave you a message, but then I'll leave you a message then about this really serious thing, And then you leave me a message a couple of days later, then I give leave a message like 4 days later. So you wind up having these conversations, which are asynchronous, voice to voice about the most serious thing, but everyone's busy. So you do it every 4 days. I mean, that's kind of what we had gotten to, me with this very close, one of my best friends. And I said, okay, I'm striking. Right? You know what I mean? That's not doing this anymore. Right? Because what happens is it's very deep, my friends, right? We get hijacked into the technology. I just want just to notice how it happens, right? Because it's possible, we start doing it and we actually lose something incredibly important. So because we have this strange option of turning off our computer and double tasking, we do, and we think we got it covered, but we don't, right? There's something that happens, right? And I apologize, tender for being like a little bit, right? In, but it's a big, that's a phallus moment, what I just did.
Well, Mark, right, when we were talking last night with Zach, he was talking about ritual. And we were talking about, I asked him what kind of ritual this is that we're doing right now, because he was describing different kinds of rituals. And he said, this is, you know, an academic lecture followed by, you know, Q&A. And I think maybe it would help if people think of these kind of events as ritualize them in some kind of way. No,
that's correct. You know, that's it. And I've said to Zach, and we've moved towards that. We're moving away from an academic conference, right? And we're actually, as you saw at the when we were at the monastery, when we did our first monastic academy, you know, kind of ritual, you know, we were looking for it there. Right, we got it much more clearly at our second monastic academy event on world religion. The third one's coming up, and now we're already in full ritualized mode, where we're consciously synergizing the best of academics, right, and the best of classical ritualized space into a new form, right? But which is what we need to do. So we are in ritual form. We are in ritual form right now, and we are engaged in, right? We're engaged in the process of sacred study, of lexis divinia. Right, we're disclosing together in deep study on the inside of the inside the deepest understanding of the nature of reality that we can. And so we're coming not just to repeat things we know. Notice I've got no notes. There's something to be said about notes. No notes. We're not reading prepackaged information, right? You know, I'm coming, right, from just kind of last five decades of kind of thinking about this, feeling it, studying it, and saying, now, how do we enter this, right? And actually disclose something of the nature of reality. We're studying the tree of life, which is the single most central visualization of the nature of reality, which has both words, text, and a visualization. It's a visualization of the tree of life. And the tree of life has 10 illuminations. There's 10 dimensions, 10 parts to the tree of life. Each one's called a sphera illumination. And as Andrew, you and I pointed out in our early conversations, right, the tree of life is all eros. So the tree of life is made up of, right, a number of erotic unions between different illuminations. Now I'm calling these illuminations sphera, which is sapir, right, which means sapphire, and it's a certain kind of light. It's a blue light. So sphera is not a sphere, it's illumination. But sphera, as we said early on, also means, anyone tell me in the chat box, so we'll know we've been here together. Sphera also means story, sipur, beautiful. So there's 10 stories. And story is an ontology of cosmos, or it's a plot line. So these are 10 stories, the 10 spherot, and one is Keter, which we've talked about as silence of presence. And the other is the explosion of intuition. And the other one's boundary breaking. And the fourth is containment, right? Each one of these is a story of reality. It's a story. It's a plot line of reality, right? And so in each of these 10 spirit live in us, we participate. It's a participatory universe. We participate in the tree of life, right? And so we are the tree of life in person. We are the tree of life, literally in person, and it's also a map of reality. And you can map a business, an organization, or you can trace world history, right, based on, or you can look into your own deepest interior or try and access a memory of the future based on the tree of life. And we need to understand all the pieces of the story, all the plot lines, and then the plot lines come together in unique erotic unions. So last conversation, we talked about the erotic union between Netzach and Hod, which is eternity, Jim Croce, if I could put time in a bottle and make this moment last forever, which is this forever moment. Whenever you talk about love, you say, when you really love someone, you say, oh my God, we love each other so much. It's going to be forever, which is beautiful, right? Right. Forever is like, this is the real thing. It's forever. And it's, sometimes it's used sarcastically, right? When Barbie says to Ken in the beginning of the Barbie movie, he leans over to kiss her and she's like, what are you doing? But not because this Ken's the wrong guy, but because there is no Barbie and Ken in reality. There is no love story. And she says to him, it's girls' night tonight, forever. meaning this is not a detail problem, right? There's no love story, right? So it's a forever. So we talked last week, a
negative kind of eternalism.
That's right. It's a negative kind of eternity. But we talked about the erotic union between Netzach, eternity, and Hod, the utter surrender to this particular moment. And that's an erotic union, right? I mean, forget about eternity. I'm just right here with you right now, right? The complete surrender and this the triumph of eternity. And what are those? What does eternity have to do, right, with the tender and fragile moment of the now that I have to surrender to? So that we talked about those two stories. Those are two sefirot, and we talked about their erotic union. So now we're in the ninth expression of the Tree of Life, which is called Yesod, Y-E-S-O-D, Yesod. And Yesod is, as we've already said, Yesod is the phallic thrust, right? So even the way I began today, although not intentionally, right, was a little bit of a tender push where I said, hey guys, let's not be acted upon. Let's not have technology act on us where we're kind of, it's acting on us. Let's push back and actually reclaim the space and not the fact that we can use it. Let's not use it. Let's actually, whether it's turning the cameras on, whatever it means, or not doing asynchronous conversation, but it's a thrust back. And it's part of this deeper sense, which means I'm not just an object in cosmos that's acted upon. I'm a subject. I act on reality. And this is huge. And this is where it begins, right? So I'm not, you know, we're going to, phallus is, and I'm going to say just a couple of things. And to you, Andrew, always your questions and your inquiries open us up. So we're going to turn it back. But let me just say just a couple of words on this phallus, and then we'll play with it. So phallus means, remember, it's always the sexual models, the erotic. So there's lines and circles. Circles are yoni. Circles are breast. Circles are the curved belly, right? And line is classically phallus. Both yoni and phallus, line and circle, live in every human being. Every human being is constituted by the interpenetration and the unique interpenetration of lines and circles, right? Everyone got that with us? Okay, beautiful. Let's kind of stay where we're in. But we're gonna not do, Andrew said, are we gonna do today both Yesod and the 10th Sfira, which is Shekhinah, which is Eros, goddess, Malchut, you know, the royalty of the goddess, which is the feminine radical receptivity. We'll do that next week. We'll do that in a month, and then we'll talk about that erotic union. But now let's focus on this quality of phallus. It's a phallus is this quality that it's a line quality, right? Right. It's a line quality. Krista got up way too early in the morning, right? It's a line quality, right? It thrusts forward, but it doesn't often stop. Its shadow is, it doesn't stop to smell the roses. It's directional, right? It's throbbing. It's alive, right? And it's this radical experience of kind of driving forward. It's loving reality open. It's initiating. It's entrepreneurial, right? It's creating, right? And it has this dimension of, and I'm going to introduce a word in here with intention. And this is, I saw my dear friend Oriana, this is with intention. It's not a casual word. I'm going to introduce the word with intention as this dimension of fuck. Right. In other words, this dimension of fuck, right? And we don't have good words, right?
Can I introduce an image here to see what you think of it? Well, what I was thinking of when you're talking is a metaphor of the guy on the motorcycle. He's going really fast in a certain direction, right? Mm-hmm. There's a woman behind him, you know, on the motorcycle. She's checking out the mountains and the view, and so that the guy on the motorcycle is just like, he's just going. He's like,
all right.
So that's the masculine. And then the feminine is this, is the appreciation of the larger picture around. It's kind of a corny image, but it's what came to
mind.
But
there's a dimension. It's a beautiful image, right? She's holding on to him. Now, of course, again, be clear, the man and woman could be reversed in that story.
So yeah, sure, of course.
Story, right? She can be on the motorcycle. Because one of the things that the feminine has done in the last 50 years very beautifully, and it's part of the evolution of the feminine, is the feminine has reclaimed its phallus. Very beautiful, right? In other words, it's the right, but the painful process has been, how do I reclaim my phallus without losing my feminine? Right? That's actually been exactly the paradox of this last 50 years. But there's been this notion, you know, and it's what happened is in World War II, women flood the workforce in the world. World War II seeds feminism. Because all of a sudden, right, what happened in France, right? Everyone's in the workforce, right? Men are off fighting and women are in the workforce. And then men come back. And then we tell the women to go back to the home and they're like, huh, I don't think so, right? Right, there's like this, no, I don't think so, right? And so it takes a little time for it to kind of gestate. You go through a generation and a half, but actually the emergence of feminism comes directly from women who actually experienced the full play of their phallus, right? Of creating, of entrepreneuring, of being in the marketplace, of decision-making, of directional, right, play that said, actually, I don't want to put that back. Actually, that's part of who I am, right?
Is there a way in which we have to be both? Like we have to be the guy in the motorcycle and the person?
We
have to be fully feminine and masculine, whether we're a man or a woman on some level.
We have to be absolutely both, which is not androgynous.
No.
The 1975, mid-70s androgyny, which we thought it was. It's not like, because androgyny basically, I always think about androgyny, right, the way it was talked about kind of in the mid-70s, you know, when we kind of said, there's no masculine and feminine. It was that moment. There's no, it doesn't really, androgyny is kind of like early ecumenicism, you know, early interfaith dialogue when, you know, early 60s, when Jews who didn't believe in Judaism met with Christians who didn't believe in Christianity, and they discovered they had a lot in common. This is fun, right? In other words, it was this pallid version of both. Right. So androgyny became tragically this pallid masculine and this pallid feminine, and not much of a difference. No, that's not what we're describing. And that's not what, Andrew, you're pointing to. We're pointing towards, right, I have a fierce masculine.
Well there's a way, like, in which some of the guys, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, please.
I just want to get the image and then it's yours. Yeah. It's a quiveringly tender feminine. Right. Both of them live together in this higher synergy in which I am fully. You know, I'm in my primary gender, right? I'm full of it. And then I embrace, right, this other dimension that's equally powerful in me, but not primary. And then I bring them into synergy and I create something new. Right. So that's right. And what we're doing this week, then back to you, brother. But so what we're doing this week is, right, yes. So these two sphirot, these two stories actually, right, need to be in union. And so one of the primary unions in the Tree of Life, and there's at least six major erotic unions in the Tree of Life, but the final one is Yesod, right, which is in the middle line. It's the Kava Emtzi, it's the middle line, right? So it's directly beneath. There's Keter is all the way on top. And then if you go down, Tiferet is right in the middle, which is beauty, heart, you know, radical harmony, radical integration of the left and the right lines. And then it goes down beneath Tiferet, you have Yesod in the center line. And Yesod is this penetrative phallus, which is then received by Shekhinah, by goddess, by she, by Malchut, by royalty, right? Which then receives the full thrust of Yesod and all the other sephirot, and then transmutes them into reality. Right? That's the Tree of Life, right? So what we want to focus on today is, what is this quality of the thrust of the Yesod that's been so demonized, right? We've lost access to this quality, right? We have this, we've problematized this sephirah. Does everyone get what I mean by that? We've literally problematized this
toxic sephirah. Masculinity.
right, toxic masculinity. Yeah. And we don't have a model, you know, my dear, beloved friend Sally Kempton, before she passed, she had one thing she wanted to do before she passed. Right? Was she wanted to write one more book And she wanted to write a book on, she had written a book called Awakening Shakti on the goddesses, which is, it's probably the best book on that that exists. It's stunning. And she wanted to write a parallel book on the gods, on the divine masculine. Right. That was, and it was this deep desire of hers to do. And we were going to work on it and talk about it together. And it didn't happen, but it's enormously necessary. In other words, let's talk about the gods. Let's talk about the divine masculine. And we basically have this notion where the masculine, it's not just the masculine, but the masculine phallus is problematized. Mm-hmm. Right? The phallus is ugly.
The penetrating aspect of existence, the clarity.
It's violating, it's penetrating, it's ugly, it's boundary breaking, it's me tooing, right? In other words, it's arousing, right? You know, and it's not that the phallus can't do some of those things, just like the yoni can do, right? You know, some major violations, right? But it's not, there's not like a good yoni and a bad phallus. That's what we think. We think there's a virtuous feminine, which sometimes slips up, but basically it's a virtuous feminine. Has everyone got that? Mm-hmm. And we think it's basically a problematic masculine that occasionally gets it right. That's our basic view of reality. That is completely wrong, right? Yeah. That is moral idiocy, right? It's also biological idiocy. And on top of it, it's stupid, right? So it's right, but I can't say, and it's dangerous and it destroys our children. It completely destroys our children. It's educationally, pedagogically, right? A psychological existential disaster. It's just not true, right? In other words, there's, and that's what Sally was saying. I've got to write this book on the divine masculine. Men are beautiful. I just want to just kind of say that, right? It's like,
well, you mentioned androgyny in the 70s, and I was thinking that, you know, there's also an aspect where, and you also mentioned gods. And if you think of the rock stars or whatever, they're parading with you know, big boots and long hair, and there's something powerful masculine about them, but they were in relationship with the feminine, as opposed to being alienated from the feminine and kind of trapped in just a male realm, right? So I think the most powerful masculinity also is in relationship to the feminine.
Let's go slow. Yeah. So when you say a rock star, right, and let's follow this and let's use this to kind of, let's really kind of
like just Robert Plant or something.
Let's explore, run or run. Okay. Let's explore this. You sowed this phallus, and this is so insanely important. So let's take a rock star. Yeah. So a rock star generally, you know, and we're engaging in caricature, and a dear friend of Christina's who was a board member for a while, is actually the Alice Cooper's manager. And so he came to our retreat, you know, our Success 3.0 retreat, and we did a dialogue on a number of things. And one of the things we talked about actually even before was, you know, the archetype of the rock star, which is the world that he kind of lived in and that KK lived in. And so let's talk about the rock star. So the rock star generally, archetypally, I'm not talking about any individual rock star, right? But the rock star archetypally both had a hugely refined relationship to the feminine and a hugely broken relationship to the feminine. So the broken relationship to the feminine were the underage girls back, you know, who went backstage.
Groupies.
Right? That was generally a broken relationship. And that was completely, was pre-Me Too, and that was just a given. You know, kind of the backstage pass was kind of a structure of the rock star world, which was a broken structure, right? It was a broken structure. But there was this other structure, which was the rock star was actually receiving the muse. He was receiving the goddess. I mean, you watch Jimi Hendrix do the Star Spangled Banner, right? At Woodstock, right? And you're like, oh my God, right? And my friend Dan Hamilton used to play it for me like every day, right? For like several years. She was every day, like, let's, right? We do Jimi Hendrix, right? Right? Jimi Hendrix, right? Like, oh my God, right? He's doing the Star Spangled Banner. And she is pouring through him. And she's pouring through Mozart, right? And she's pouring through Mick Jagger, right? Right? And right. In other words, you know, who's doing this, at, you know, he's pushing 80 and he's doing it. And he's pouring, right? In other words, the rock star is the artist who's receiving the grace. The rock star is touched by the divine feminine. The orchestra is touched by the goddess.
Which is why they often wear makeup and boots. And you know, I mean, it's visually, you could see it visually there as well, not just the emotion.
But here's the and. So I have two friends who were very close to Michael, right? To Michael Jackson. I'll mention only the second one, right? Who was his manager and one of his closest friends, who was a fellow at the think tank, right? Who managed, who was his, Michael's publicist for a while, right? Howard Bloom. And you've all heard Howard Bloom. Howard and I have done many, many dialogues, and he's one of the kind of rock star theoretical physics minds of NASA. But the hidden story of Howard Bloom is that he was the leading rock star publicist for 12 years and ran the preeminent firm. And he found people like Peter Gabriel. Look up the Howard story. Howard's a wonderful, he has a wild set of stories that we've talked about Michael. And Michael is this beautiful combination between rigorous discipline, rigorous. And when he was training, right, and kind of, and learning steps, right? You know, he was like the most rigorous, brutal, right? Marines, again, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of a rigorous, kind of thrusting forward, creative reaching. And then at some point he surrenders and the goddess moves him, right? And the goddess moves him. I mean, in other words, you know, and Michael Jackson was moved by the goddess, and there's no question about it. And we don't know about kind of in his personal world, how the world played and what was true and what wasn't true. And he was plagued by kind of, you know, a very, very painful last 15 years in which his relationship to the sensual world was never clarified. And he was in massive pain, right? And so we don't know that. That's not ours to do here. But what we do know is, right, is that he was, and that's the nature of the rock star. And so what we need to do is to be a sod, right? I need to actually bring those two together, right? And as I need to be actually be in full surrender and in full penetration, but across the board, right? With every man, with every woman, right? With every engagement, with every, right? But first I need to, and this is what I want to kind of, and let me turn it back to you and ask it about your life, Andrew, if I can, and I'm going to take your role. I'm going to say it in a kind of a dramatic way, right? You have to find your fuck. I'm going to kind of say it that simply. Find your fuck means, and it's a word we use a lot in our circle, and we use it with intention. We use the word with intention. We don't say find your creative, right? No, we say find your fuck. And find your fuck means your edge of creativity, right? The place that you want to thrust forward, right? And the thrusting forward doesn't need to be in public. You can find your fucking your own internal transformation and then challenge, right, old patterns in a way that you thought you never could and birth something new in the internal chemistry and valence of your soul that will never be seen public, and you found your fuck. So finding your fuck doesn't mean I'm Steve Jobs and I'm creating Apple. Right? That's not what it means, right? Right? But it means something, right? Every man and woman has to access, to have a tree of life. I have to find my fuck, which is what's, right, Shati? What's my creative edge where I can be here, yeah, right now and not someplace else, right? And I'm fully present, right? And I'm loving this moment open, and I'm fucking this moment open, and I can actually do that. And I'm steady. Yeah. And that's one of the qualities of phallus, is steadiness. I'm not looking here, looking there, texting this, doing that, right? Doing that. No. I'm steady. The phallus is steady. That's one of its, right. It's steady from its steadiness, right? It thrusts forward.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the find your fuck is not find your project.
Yeah.
It's like find your fuck. And if you don't find your fuck, you become abusive. Or you become abused. So I want to get this. When you bypass your fuck, you create abuse. Because you can't bypass the energy of fuck in the world. Yeah. It's a dimension of the tree of life. You can't say, I'm going to give up my fuck, and I'm going to please my family. I'm going to, right? And there are compromises that always need to be made. But if you give up on the primacy of your fuck, you die.
Yeah.
The tree of life wilts.
I think that's the struggle. That's like the struggle you go through every single day, or at least if you're on a path, like a real path. I don't mean any religious path necessarily, but an artistic path, or because if you're not in that state of concentration and edge, then you feel use, especially if you're a man, I would say you feel useless. You feel you have the masculinity needs to give or it dies. It's something like that.
Yeah, I need another, and there are different stages of life, right? So there can be a stage of life where I'm more in the flowing eros of my dynamic feminine, which is beautiful, right? And there's another stage of life where I'm more in, right, the finding of fuck of the phallus. There's another stage of life when they're beautifully synergized, but you can never abandon, neither man or woman, you can never abandon the primacy of telos, right? Mm-hmm. The terrible joy, right? And the joyful terror, right? Of being challenged, right? At the very edge to actually push through. And what I do is when I'm challenged to do something new, when I've got to find my fuck, I often collapse because I'm afraid of the challenge. And the body does what the body does, but it's actually the mind. Right. In other words, there's a challenge. Phallus is about living at the edge.
Yeah.
Right. It's about living, you know, and when femininity critiques boxing, and by the way, there's good reason to critique boxing. It's a sick sport, to be completely clear. But the reason men box, besides of the commodification of boxing, which has gotten commodified, but ideally, what's the boxing moment? Why do men shit talk each other? Right. You know, I'll get on the phone with Aubrey or with Aaron, my two of my friends and that I study with, and we'll spend the first 2-3 minutes and we'll basically say, huh. And we'll say, and I'll say to, you know, Aaron, who happens to play in a realm which involves, you know, certain physical skills that I don't have, right? You know, kind of at a high level, I'll say to him, huh, really a shame you can't quite get that ball in there the right way. I said, I trained you, but like, all right. Or I'll say to Aubrey, like, really, really a shame you can't really lift too much today, but I guess you're kind of old and you've hit 43 and a little sad, but you know, it's okay. But I've got to do it with a complete straight face. That you would never get on the phone with the feminine and do shit talking. Cause they would say like, that's weird. Why are you doing that? That's a weird thing to do. Right. Yeah. But men get on the phone. My friend, Warren Farrell, this is very funny. He gets on the phone. He wrote The Boy Crisis. He gets on the phone and he'll say something like, or I'll say something to him, and I apologize for this, we'll edit. I'll say something like, yeah, I just saw KK last week. We had a great time. Oh, she didn't mention that? That's how Warren gets on the phone, right? Now, what is he doing? It's like, he's playing. It's this conquest male competitive female
thing.
It's
arousing you to a fight, playful fight.
It surfaces the fight. Right. Yeah. It's
just like young kids, like my son, he's 4. He's just so happy when we can do a little fight. It's joy to him, complete joy. Totally. Like he's sweet and he likes flowers and everything else too. But when he can fight, that's one of his biggest joys.
Totally. And we develop school structures all through the United States. And Michael Gurian has done fantastic work on the way school structures are developed to female teachers, almost all the teachers are female, right? And they're themselves trained to kind of try and develop a certain kind of feminine boy.
Yeah.
And the boy
frustration, basically. Yeah.
The boy that's acting out is basically men have left the elementary schools, just saying education.
Yeah.
There are virtually no male teachers in elementary schools. And that's kind of just by itself is kind of shocking. Now we want female teachers, that's fantastic, but we need obviously female and male teachers, and you need roughhousing.
Yeah.
Which
rough and tumble play is all mammals do it and they love it. And
it's critical.
Encouraged. It's critical. Yeah.
No, when Zion, when I'm with Zion, right, Zion wants to fight. Right. You know, we sit and we watch superhero movies, and then we analyze them and we pray. But if we're not engaging in some fight, right? You know, and it's not like, right? And then KK will say, that was too hard. I said, no, that wasn't even vaguely hard enough. And then Zion will say, boom. You know, and I'm like, whoa, that was too hard, right? You know, but in other words, but there's and obviously there's parameters, obviously, but in other words, and it's that sense, and that's not, here's the thing. So evolutionary psychology tells us, oh, and this is this, you know, not this is, and feminism has repeated this in multiple volumes. That's this outmoded, you know, fight or flight, you know, kind of, you know, adaption, evolutionary adaption that still remains in men that's now unnecessary. And now let's say, no, that's Yasod.
Yeah. Right? Well, I like to say a provocative thing, like a provocative thing. When you talk about this early education thing, and I was reading in a book by Eric Neumann about early history and how there were castration cults.
Right.
And I think that almost the this sort of attitude towards men is a castration cult. You know, it's always trying to undermine that way that men are tough with each other in a loving way, right? Because if you get a bunch of men together, they don't gossip, you know, in the same way, you know, way that women do. They tend to be very supportive of each other, even though they play and they fight.
Men are.
But it seems to be a misunderstood in the culture what that is.
This is really important, right? What you're saying. So first off, men are insanely tender with each other. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is the first thing. I mean, I was at Zion's bar mitzvah, okay, and you know myself and Sean and Victoria, and Vipassana, excuse me, and KK, and we're watching Zion and his friends dance, and we're watching the boys dance with each other, and we're like, oh my God, it was beautiful, like the care and tenderness, which with these 13-year-old boys dance with each other, blew our hearts open, right? And I remember Kathy and I were talking about this like 3-4 years ago. And Kathy sent me a great book. Kathy, if you remind me the name of the book written by the Harvard lady about boys, but the tenderness of boys. You know exactly what I'm talking about. N-I-O-B-E, is that her name? Something like that. But there's a fantastic book, which I read.
You mean then. The Peggy Ornstein book?
No, not the Peggy Ornstein book. Peggy Ornstein's more that she characters the classical boys.
Oh, I know what book you mean. Yeah, I can't remember the name. I'll think of it. Yeah,
and if you find it, put it in the chat box. It's a fantastic book. I think the author's last name is N-I-O-B-E, but I can't quite remember and I read the book. It's a fantastic book. And it's about the relationship between boys, right? And boys between each other are insanely tender, right? Insanely, and loyal. And they have these incredible conversations. So it's not that the rough and tumble, right, excludes, right, this quivering tenderness. There's this quivering tenderness, and there's this, you know, kind of beautiful competitiveness. And what we have to do is, by the way, is we have to liberate the tyranny, right, of culture, which is this, as Andrew said, right, citing you in the third person, Andrew, right, we've created a new castration culture. And so we need to revivify the divine masculine in some fundamental way. And let me pass it back to you before we take the, yeah, please. It's great.
Oh, no. In the men's work that I've done, there's a way in which also men need to commune with each other, I believe, outside of with women not being a witness to that. And that's very profound. And I think the fact that everybody's all mixed together all the time is, you know, we should have spaces where we're mixed, but we should also have these absolutely. Other kind of spaces that are not like boys club, you know?
You know, absolutely. No,
but actual sort of where people, our men are doing, you know, men's work and that kind of thing is Warren Farrell and that movement is much more vital to culture, I think, than people really understand, and I think it's very important.
And let's say two things about it, okay? And then I was going to take a look at the chat box for a second. Niobe, okay, yay, I got the name right. Okay, I spelled it, but I couldn't pronounce it, right? So it's called Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendship, and the Crisis of Connection by Niobe Way, right? And it's a great book, everyone, just about boys. But let me just go to the men's movement. Let's get back to, I want to say with Yasod and Phallus. Mm-hmm. And here's the weakness, and I've said this to Warren. It's the weakness.
There's a weakness too. Yeah,
there's a huge weakness to you know. And I love Warren, by the way. Just I love Warren. He's a dear close friend. He's been the head of the vice president of gender in the center for years. Kathy had him up at Exeter, right, to kind of talk about back in the day. And he's a beautiful man. It's not about Warren per se, but there's a general assumption that you can actually assert anything without there being a field of value. So you can assert the masculine. And so without there being a value, I'm going to go slow here, mm-hmm. an actual value called yesod. In other words, you have to recognize that there's a value in the tree of life, which is the quality of yesod that needs to be honored and preserved. And if you don't do that, so in Warren's book, The Boy Crisis, right, he was left with this huge problem, which is, so what should boys do, right? You know, after the crisis is over, talks about the boy crisis. And so, by the way, Judy Cornea, we love seeing your hand floating in the screen. It's very mystical. Just letting you know that we got your hand on the screen. We're waving to you and loving you over there. Okay. So yay, that was a good mystical backdrop. I know that everyone was kind of like, what was going on over there? Okay. I know. There we go. So we're missing you and loving you, whatever's happening there. We hope it's good. Okay. So the weakness of Warren's work is there's no place to go. So Warren's is purpose, right? So I shared with Warren kind of the unique self moment, and he tried to build the book, you know, kind of around unique self, but without naming uniqueness as a value. In other words, phallus has to be a value. And the men's groups have fallen apart. Just to say, men's groups have fallen apart. Warren invited me to his men's group, right? Yeah. And I did it for 13 years because I love Warren and I love John, you know, and John Gray's in it and Terry Nelson, as I met Terry. But actually, it doesn't quite work.
That's funny. I have the same experience of being in a men's group for a while that fell apart. You know,
there's no context of value, right? In other words, men have to be in phallus together, thrusting something open together. Lord of the Rings, right? You know, when he gives this speech, right, and he says, you know, the guy who's going to be, what's his name? He's going to be the king of Aragon, right? What is his name? God, I love him. What's his name? Anyways, he's Aragon and Arwen, right? So it's Aragon who's going to be the king of Gondor. So Aragon gives the speech and he says, you know, there may come a day, right, when men betray each other and don't stand with each other, but this is not that day, right? And he gives this incredible speech and your whole, if I was a woman, I'd want to make love with him then, like for the next time. He's beautiful. He's like, oh my God, right? He's totally beautiful. And this is not, there may come a day where men are in their smallness, but this is not that day, right? And so the men are coming together, right, to stand for justice. That they're coming together for a cause, right? They're coming together to storm the barricades. And whether it's men or men and women, but it's this phallus is not, we get together just and look in each other's eyes. Yes, there's a tenderness, right? There's deep secrets, boys, friendships, right? And there's a fierceness, right? And we're together and we're doing something together. I just finished, you know, I mean, those of us who know each other a little bit well over the years know that I have a little bit of an obsession with the idea with heroes, because I think heroes are the early adopters of homo amor, of the new human and the new humanity, what we call that, right? So hero literature is very important. So whenever there's a piece of hero literature out, I try and, you know, as much as I can, I try and find it. So in the late night, which is part of the reason I'm so tired, in the late night of the last 2 weeks, besides just having too much to do in the last 5-6 days, but on top of it all, right, I found this series on the, it's called Brothers in Arms. And it was done by Spielberg, right, and Tom Hanks. And it's about one of the groups that I followed for last 25 years. I followed them and read about them. And they're called Easy Company. And Easy Company were the boys that landed in Normandy. And Hanks did an early movie about it called Saving Private Ryan. Mm-hmm. But that was just an early take on it. And this is about these boys, right, who are just brothers and they love each other and they stand for each other and they die for each other on the beaches of Normandy. And it follows these Easy Company in the last year and a half of the war. And you're like, you cry through the whole movie. You're like, right, this is men. These are not, right, demonized problem. This is phallus, right? Mm-hmm. And you realize that this phallus allows all of us to be on this call right now, right? This quality of phallus, this is phallus. This is guns. This is thrusting forward. There's a shadow of phallus, right? Iranian 200 missiles, phallus trying to land, right, in Israel, right, in the last 24 hours, right? There's shadows of phallus, but this was holy phallus. This was holy phallus. This was men standing for justice.
Yeah.
And it's hold. It's that moment in Braveheart.
You know, it's a way.
Phallus says to the boys, hold, right? They're being charged by the other troops. Hold, steadiness. It's phallus. Hold till they're hold. Boom, right? So this is, we need this quality, and we need it not just in justice, we need it in our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing.
It's amazing. Well,
an insight I had as you were speaking is that the masculine is something to do with attention being pure, and that, you know, if it wavers, or if it is seduced even by the feminine, like it's unseducible.
Yes.
And that is that the strange thing about that is that's the most attractive thing to a woman is a guy who is completely unseducible. Like the reason that groupies are screaming at a Beatles concert is because those guys are, you know, they're so deep in the music that they're beyond, in a way, like.
Yeah,
they're beyond. You could call it clarified desire, but they're beyond something. It's beyond
clarified desire. There's no, and I'm totally with you, Andrew. Right, what you're pointing towards, if I can, with your permission, we want a quality in the masculine, and you sowed in phallus as it lives in men and women, but I'm never drawing the masculine, which can't be fucked with. It's unfuckable. Yeah. That's what you mean by unseducible, meaning I trust you to follow your muse.
Yeah.
I trust you to follow your direction. And actually, when you're not following your direction, I'm actually not aroused.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, you're not unfuckable. I don't want to fuck you. Right. Yeah. Essentially. Right. And in a word, which is why, by the way, when men retire and come home and they want their woman at their feet, right? And the woman's like, no, let me feel your thrust. Where are you going now? We just hanging out the next 30 years? Where are you going? What are we going to love open together? Right? And so when I feel the masculine, whether in a man or a woman, but in this case, kind of, let's say you sowed, when I feel its steadiness, right? And you pointed at really so beautifully, which is you pointed to the steadiness of attention. Right. And in some sense, one of the things I've talked about in the last few years, Brother Andrew, is that the internet, as it emerged in the mid-90s, is the exteriorization of the postmodern mind. So the internet is the physical exteriorization of the postmodern mind. From the mid-90s, the postmodern mind demonizes the phallus, demonizes the masculine, and then starts basically creates the technology that is, as Nicholas Carr points out in his book, The Shallows, he calls it the most attention scattering technology, quote, end of quote, that's ever been created. Meaning you're on the internet, and what happens on the internet is actually the internet emasculates human beings. You can't.
Yeah, like porn does. And
steady attention. That's right. There's no, you're going there. You're going there. You're looking there. You're looking there. You're looking at your phone, right? You're scrolling, right? And there's no steady attention. And actually, as a man or a woman, if I'm dissociated from my yesod, right? From my steady attention, and my steady attention is actually up for sale, right? I can be easily seduced with a bunch of trinkets alike. Right. All right. Some little shiny trinket seduced my attention. I'm actually out of integrity or out of, and it's a beautiful word, right? Alignment, line. I'm out of alignment, right? With the full thrust. And then the truth is, I'm not arousing to myself. I'm not arousing to she, to goddess, to the field. Right.
Yeah. And you're masturbating. You're not fucking, if I could be crude, right? It's a masturbatory thing, right?
It's not like
there's no attention. There's no intensity in that. It's not embodied. It's a sort of a masturbatory world where you know.
Yeah, I'd say let me with permission, brother, right? I'd say it's a pornographic world, right? In other words. Let me say the difference. Pornography is about is all about sensation without depth. If you ask me for a definition of pornography, I would say the pornographic universe is sensation without depth. The erotic universe is the merging of infinite sensation and infinite depth together, where sensation is an expression of depth. That's a very, I think it's a good distinction. Now, the world of self-pleasuring, which has been often called right?
I didn't mean to be speak against that. Like, I don't think
there's something wrong. I would say that's right. No, you're exactly right. I don't think we want to take a, I would say there's different kinds of self-pleasuring, different kinds of masturbation. Mm-hmm. There is a self-pleasuring, which actually can be an intensely beautiful spiritual practice. And by the way, this is not a moment for tantric instructions to anyone, right? I know anything about tantra or I know anything about tantric instructions, but I've heard that they existed in the world someplace, right? But in other words, but this is not a moment for that. But it, you know, if somebody would ever do that, right? I would say the first instruction would be to self-pleasure and not explode, right? Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, to actually be in the process of being so deep in yourself, right? So deep in yourself. And I'm talking about self-pleasuring, even if you don't have a beloved, right? Now, everyone has a beloved, everyone has it, right? But in other words, if you don't have a kind of beloved that you're exchanging in that way, where you actually engage in this entering so deeply, right, into right your inner place, but it's not, and the reason we don't know how to do that, so we demonize self-pleasuring, and we have this whole set of words to describe it, all of them, which are so horrible, right? You know, someone was giving me the other day this list of words for self-pleasuring. You're like, oh my God, these words are so bad, right? Like whacking the duck or something. There's a whole list of crazy words. Yeah. Right? We could do an exercise. Everyone could write in like kind of the chat box. Come on, just for fun. You can write words. Let's write words for self-pleasuring in the chat box. Come on. Samuel can come up with any. Come on, help us out, guys. Let's get a bunch of crazy words. What are the crazy words for self-pleasuring? Who's willing to do it? Now, you know, no one will think that you do it if you get the words picking cherries. I never heard that one before. Okay.
Me neither. I've heard that one.
Okay. Yeah. Beat the meat. Okay. Okay. Rukin. Okay. We got the idea. Right. Okay. What? Wanking off. Right. There's a whole, like these words, the words are like, they're so bad. And it's like,
wood. Krista has the most creative ones I've found.
Right. They're so bad. Right. Because we don't know what to do with it. Right. Yeah. It's actually fiercer than self-pleasuring, which is a little bit too, right? But there's some, right? So this distinction, right? But even, it's more than even self-pleasuring, right? It's actually a form, this is very deep, okay? So in the lineage of Solomon, there's a hidden tradition, and this is something we don't usually talk about publicly, there's a hidden tradition, which is called Shashua. Shashua means divine pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a description of divinity self-pleasuring.
Mm-hmm.
And in the overflowing of divinity self-pleasuring creates reality. So there's two traditions in terms of the manifestation of reality in the hidden text of the lineages, and this is not talked about. The classical one that's talked about is that the world emerges from lovemaking, right? Yeah. Between two dimensions, two facets of divinity. But there's a second lineage tradition which is very strong, which is that the world is an overflow of divine Shashua, divine autoerotic self-play, right? Now imagine for a second that we didn't demonize self-pleasuring. We actually transformed it into right, a sacred context. And I would say that the amount of damage done, I'm going to start with men because there's a different experience of self-pleasure with women. And I know that because I was a woman, right, in my past life. Right? But I've spoken to enough women about it who've all confirmed that, you know, over the last 40, 50 years, right? Our dear friend, you know, Lori Galperin, who was doing deep research for Masters and Johnson, has confirmed that there's a lot of literature that confirms it. Right. But there's for men, because we're talking about yesod. So the shame
of
male self-pleasuring is the shaming of yesod, of this quality of the phallus. We shame the phallus, right?
Absolutely.
Shame the phallus. And even that's true in religious culture.
Yep.
Right. Whether it's Orthodox Jewish culture or Hindu Orthodox culture, but it's also true in secular culture. In other words, men young boys are raised on high speed internet porn. And I don't think there's a young boy in the world who ever signed his name triumphantly, right, on his masturbatory experience with porn. Right. I mean, when I say sign, I mean, who had this wonderful aftertaste with the sense of his nobility and his wonder and his goodness, right? Here I am. No. Actually, it's all the strange words we use to describe, right, this inability to honor, right, the phallus in its interiority, right?
It's a shameful act of impotence.
Right.
That's how the culture seems to call it.
A shameful act of narcissism.
Yeah.
It's impotent. You're right. That's beautiful. It's impotent in that it doesn't potentiate anything in the world. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this hidden tradition in Kabbalah. You know, in the Lurianic traditions, there's a man named Avi El-Kayam. And Avi's a brilliant Lurianic scholar. And Avi and I talked about this maybe 30 years ago. We had a series of conversations about this, right? But Avi's done some, but it's very, very beautiful. Shabtai Tzvi, one of the things that Shabtai Tzvi, the Sabbatian tradition, was doing was trying to actually reclaim these sources, right? But in other words, we need to reclaim Yesod. I mean, it's such a big deal. We need to reclaim the dignity of masculine sexuality. And if I can just tell one more with permission, I was just talking to someone, you know, deeply in a very deep context, and it's an archetypal story, which has happened many times. Let me just tell it archetypally, where this person was in relationship, right, with a woman, and they had this moment where he wanted to have sex and she didn't, and you know, and she had done, you know, she was dressed in a way that was inviting. They were in a relationship. In other words, they were partners, and they were in a room. So it wasn't, you know, it's not some kind of weird incel, you know, kind of pathology there, right? And so they talk about it, and he convinces her, right? And say, hey, let's really do this. And she says, okay, right? And so they begin, and it's kind of not working. So he steps back, right? And then, you know, a year later, right, she calls him and says, you know, I feel like you raped me. Now, to be clear, there was no physical pressing. It was just a conversation. And what that is an utter demonization of phallus. In other words, phallus, whether it exists in men or women, a woman has a right to try and convince a man to make love when he doesn't want to and arouse his access, right, to lovemaking, right? And a man has a right to try and convince a woman to make love when she doesn't want to. And she has a right to say an absolute no. And he has a right to say an absolute no. And we get to trust her autonomy, right? And we don't come back and turn that into rape. Right. I mean, it's very, very, very big deal. This kind of, so the phallus is this, the phallus as it lives in men or women is this radical desire for sexing.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's not.
So how do we rediscover the dignity of a positive kind of seduction?
We relocate seduction, and we relocate fuck, and we relocate eros in the field of value.
Yeah, got
that,
it.
That, right? I mean, that's it. That's the entire, that is the tree of life. The whole point of the tree of life is that the sphirot, the illuminations, are constantly trying to seduce each other. Reality is, all of reality is seduction. And seduction means that the inherent structure of reality is cajoling, inviting, seducing a new moment, right? A new moment in which there's this penetration in which reality is penetrated by the thrust of Yesod to generate something new and emergent, even as reality is receiving everything that previously existed, right? And by the way, that is a good reading of Whitehead's Occasionalism. If you got that comment, anyone, you got it. If you didn't, delete it, right? But the point is, right, reality is thrusting forward, even as it's receiving all of the previous moment. And then it's generating this beautiful new thing. And the reality is always seducing. But holy seduction means I don't violate your boundary. Yeah. Holy, I'm trying to seduce you, right? You're trying to seduce me to break the boundary of your limitation for the sake of your deepest fulfillment. That's holy seduction. We've exiled holy seduction to unholy seduction. So I'm trying to get you to break your, to seduce you, to violate your appropriate boundary, not for the sake of the fulfillment of some new and beautiful emergence, a new value, but for my own egoic gratification, which ignores what your deep needs are. That's a huge distinction, right?
Yeah, it's a distinction between just getting your rocks off because you're desperate,
right?
To actually,
let's stay with that. Okay, I mean, and notice how all the phrases become getting your rocks off because you're desperate. Okay, so I'm going to use that exact phrase. That's Andrew's holy text. Not your only one. I know you've got many, but I'm going to freeze frame on that one just for a second, right? But we won't stay in it. Okay, right. So even quote getting your rocks off when you're desperate, that doesn't give you whether you're a man or a woman. So I want to first I want to just not just apply that to men, right? Right. There are, thank God, right, many, many wondrous expressions of the feminine in the world that want to get their rocks off because they're desperate. Of course there are, right? Because the notion that desire and radical desire lives only in men is absurd, right? It's a fundamental violation of feminine desire, which we demonize and we call Lilith. That's what we do, right? In other words, Lilith is the demon. She's the she demon. So first off, we need to, you know, and Laura Kipnis, you know, was being interviewed in a round table during Me Too, the height of Me Too, right? Laura Kipnis is a brilliant writer. She wrote a book called The Female Thing. She wrote a book called Against Love. She's written five or six great books. She's hilariously funny when she wants to be, and she's also quite cutting when she wants to be, but she's a brilliant power feminist writer. And Laura Kipnis says, and I apologize again to Laura Kipnis speaking, not me, but she was right. She says, wasn't there any woman in all of these Me Too stories, I'm quoting her, who wanted to get laid? And you're like, oh! But actually, why do we think that only men want to have sex and women don't?
Yeah, right? Why do we think that?
Literally demonized.
It's a strange thing, actually, because I feel like
it's absurd.
You're always accused of that, right? You just want to have sex, and that's, you have this motivation.
No, the bit, you know, you're
right, but it's not, it's not even true, because men, you know, worship women like in a religious way. So it's not that they want it. They don't just want to have sex. You know,
men are wildly, men die for a woman's love. Men are wildly devotional. Yeah. Men are willing to give up their lives to earn the tenderness of a woman's love. Yeah. Men are wildly devotional. And let's get what you're saying is so right. Our basic cultural assumption is he's trying to get it, and she has got to decide when to give it up. That's the basic equation, right? Now, if you're virtuous, you only give it up if you've gotten enough in return, right? That's virtue, right? I mean, long-term commitment, etc. Right? But why would we assume that a sexual encounter is when he's trying to get it and she's just trying to give it up? How about, here's a novel idea, tree of life. Two people are meeting with radical devotion, radical respect, radical integrity, quivering tenderness, which is not in any way dissociated from radical fierceness, because tenderness and fierceness live together, in the fullness of feminine desire and the fullness of masculine desire, and knowing that both feminine and masculine desire wax and wane as the moon waxes, right? And full mad honor, right, with a deep bow and with a experience that we're participating in the larger field of Eros, and now we've revivified the tree of life, right? We've revivified phallus, and as long as we demonize phallus, as long as we shame desire. And so what Laura Kipnis was saying is, I mean, actually, in the end, we all agree with Me Too. Just I want to make that clear. We all agree that there is some small dimension of the masculine and a small dimension of masculine culture that actually took the ability to cross boundaries as a given. And Sally Kempton used to describe when she was writing at the New York Times, said you would walk by, a guy would slap you on the ass and think that was okay. Why is that? So thank God for Me Too, right? Thank God for the emergence of laws of sexual harassment. Sexual harassment wasn't even on the books. I mean, thank God for kind of 70s feminism that named sexual harassment and the men that participate in it, and that we created appropriate boundaries, and that the appropriate part of the Me Too movement, the spark of holiness, did what it did. Yes, we're a yes to that. I shouldn't even have to say that, but let's say it just so it's, of course. And Laura Kepnes's point is that we can't inherently problematize this dimension of the tree of life, which is called radical desire. And radical desire lives, the phallus lives, if you will. The phallus lives in the feminine and the masculine. And it's actually the sexual model's eros. It's the sacred quality of thrusting forward, right? And it's fierce and it's divine, right? Yeah. Now let's see if we can go the last step. What would it be if we could actually also access, right, this erotic union in our own self-pleasuring, right? In other words, instead of demonizing. Well,
there are traditions of that, and they're you know, I think in the East, the inner tantras are, there's many schools where they don't have that as, they don't have the same taboo or sinfulness associated with it. In fact, it's understood to be psychotechnology generating bliss and union and all kinds of things.
Right.
And power.
Right.
And
those are rare, by the way. And there's a narrow band. Most of the tantric schools actually reject embodied sexuality, but there's a very narrow band of actual practice within the tantric schools. I actually did a whole beautiful dialogue.
Well, they're not tantric schools. They're tantric. They're sutric schools with tantric imagery. If they're actually engaging in real sexuality,
that's totally correct. And if you would summarize tantra in one sentence, and when I say tantra, I don't mean Eastern tantra, but I mean the tantric strain of literature across all traditions. I would say tantra is the principle of non-rejection.
Yeah, I like that. You've said that before. Yeah.
Nothing's entirely off the table. Everything has a sacred context. And if we don't, here's the funny thing, Andrew, there's a project that Christina and Claire and I are working on, which is around, lines and circles, right? And it's kind of, we talk about line sexing and circle sexing, right? But there's this broader lines and circles that's going to become a volume of the phenomenology. And in the end, that's what we decided. Then it's going to be its own volume. So it'll be in the phenomenology, right? But it's this project. And we've been, I think KK, Claire and I have been talking about it for like 7-8 years, this particular line circle thing. And there was a moment we decided we'd make it a volume in the phenomenology, but it's about these two different moments that both need to be honored. And one is circle sexing, and circle sexing or circle eros is, you go round and round. You're not trying to get any place, right? And you're in the depth, right, of this kind of slow sexing, which you can do for 15 days, right? Mm-hmm. Which is intensely beautiful, right? Right. Slow sexing for 15 days. I'll have what she had, right? Right. In other words, that's like, oh, that's right. And you can kind of see, by the way, you can kind of look across the screen. You can see, by the way, all the women's faces light up and the men are like, huh, what does that even mean? You could just see it was like hilarious to watch. All the women kind of got it and made it. And the men are looking like, what does that even mean? Right. Another, so there's right there is something to be said to biology here, right?
I had an interview with a tantric teacher who had sex for 22 hours and I didn't really understand what that means.
Right,
I
right.
There's this 22 hours.
Right, 22 hours is a long time, right? So circle sexing is this very beautiful, right, this very beautiful emergence. And line sexing is this very beautiful emergence. And we need to dignify both and bring us to this place of where the line and the circle penetrate each other. And we actually, and this is maybe this way, as we move towards closing, we can't, you might think like, why are we talking about this? We're talking about this because everything depends on this. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you would ask me, what's the root of the meta crisis, right? The meta crisis that we're so committed to, right? Right, to responding to not turning our way from, right? And, I had this crazy moment yesterday where someone was doing a dialogue with me, and the dialogue turned quite aggressive. It's the first time that it ever happened on a podcast. And the person had done a podcast with me before that wasn't published, and they wanted to do kind of a part two. And I thought, oh, sure. And so I got on, and so I kind of talked about existential risk. And the person, well, is existential risk real? And this started with a very aggressive challenge. existential risk is not real, which was fine. And then it moved into a challenge of like, you know, why you're trying to control the world by asserting that there's actually shared value that's real, right? Which is kind of the postmodern rejection of anyone who says there's a dharma, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Anyone who says there's a source code. Yeah. And then it got even more aggressive. So I kind of challenged the person, right? And you know, and Zach and Keke were kind of, we're here and just listening a little bit, right? And I challenged the person, and I mean, I kind of got, you know, quite upset. Right? And I said, so let me just be clear, right? So, you know, and Kathy, this is like an extra moment. I said, so Hitler in gas chambers, is that morally wrong? She wouldn't answer the question. Right. And so I kept pressing and pressing, and basically said she refused to make the simple assertion. As an intelligent, well-read, cultured, somewhat known cultural figure who'd been tracking, you know, kind of, you know, work that we'd been doing in a number of parallel organizations that are doing their own work, completely independent of us, right? You know, kind of, you know, starting with the Club of Rome, right? You know, and it's way back when, kind of tracking kind of the limits of growth kind of thing, the meta crisis kind of thing, right? And basically the accusation was that, you know, this person actually said to me, said, you're engaged, the word was a techno-fascist communist domination kind of, you know, those were the words. They were like, whoa, that's a lot, right? And the idea was, how are you going to totalize and claiming that value is real, that you can name value, right? That's a dominating move, right? Mm-hmm. And just straight out clearly, value is a matter of perspective. So I said, okay, 1 second, woman in the gas chamber holding her baby choking. Is that wrong? Wouldn't name it as wrong. So it's like, it's a big deal, right? And it's the project of value. And that's what the Tree of Life is about, right? It's about value. And sexuality itself has to be recontextualized in the field of value. If we don't, right? Sex itself, there's a reason why in the world today, people are having less and less and less sex,
yeah,
right? By the way, across open societies and closed societies, and we've done the research on it in the phenomenology, the people are having less and less and less sex. And the sex itself is becoming caricatures of the phallic thrust of Yesod. So for example, right, and you mentioned earlier, Kathy, Peggy Ornstein. So she, of course, did her second book, which was on, she did a girls on girls and sex, and she did it on boys and sex. And she's now writing, and Keke just sent me an article, you know, on, you know, men choking, on choking becoming this meat part of sexing, right? Now, I don't want to get involved with anyone's personal sexual life, but I don't want anyone choking me, right? In other words, right? And it's like kind of dangerous, right? And people passing out and, right? But it kind of a scandal, this kind of default move to choking, because the word, and again, I'm not, to be clear, so if someone has a particular attraction to that kind of sexing and it's done, you know, with care and honor and mutuality, blessings to everyone. So I don't want to demonize if someone has a particular kind of attraction to that. I don't want someone to kind of walk out of this phone call. So anything can be done as long as it's not harmful in a way that's appropriate and contextualized. What I'm talking about is this has become the default. This is the default, right? Right? A boy moves to choke a girl, right? Right? Or a boy moves to choke a boy or a girl, right? Right? But in sexing, right? There was another, a friend of ours made a movie, right? Which was actually quite powerful, called Just for One Day. And it turned out it was two women. It was a choking scene, right? Right. And we didn't realize that actually, because it wasn't in the actual final cut. And the one of the actresses says, I went someplace. And then the person told us afterwards that it was a choke moment, right? It's like, whoa, why are we choking each other? Right? You know what I mean? In other words, there's like, whoa, that should not be the default. That might be this very, very advanced, you know, once in a blue moon, right? No play in the word blue, right? Right. You know, kind of, you know, right. Sorry, I know. Right. But, you know, but that should not be the default of sexuality. Like, hello. You know, as my,
you know, the film In the Realm of the Senses, where have you seen that film? Well, it's a film where a geisha, they're choking In the Realm of the Senses.
I have not.
They're engaged in choking, and you know, they leave society, they leave the war, and it's a erotic movie, and she ends up killing him, you know, in their love play, choking and cutting off his member and putting it in a box and wandering around Tokyo, And this is a real thing, actually. And she was put in prison, and she came out, and she ran a kind of a geisha house. And well, I mean, I was thinking about that, and
when you were
talking about it, because it's sort of when people fall out of society, they go to sort of an extreme.
And if we don't honor the dignity of fuck, the dignity of Yesod, then it goes underground. And then it expresses itself. And again, I want to just say this again. I'm not objecting saying this is some forbidden. I'm saying this is, if one would engage, it would have to be with such care, with such boundaries, and with such permission, right? In other words, the notion that you have a default right to choke someone in sexuality is insane.
Well, the whole metaphor of this movie was that Yesod has been cut off, you know, and this was the beginning of the war. It was the metaphor of the movie, in a sense.
We need to reclaim a healthy, embodied, gorgeous, beautiful, and you can never have, here's the thing, you can never have fierceness without tenderness. Yeah, I just want to say that, everybody, it makes me cry. You can never have fierceness without tenderness, and you can never have fierceness without compassion. And compassion means that you can feel the other person, okay? Mm. You can feel, and if you can't feel the other person, right? And you're not always protecting your beloved, then whatever you're doing is not lovemaking, right? And it's, in other words, and there can never be fuck without lovemaking. You can never, right? Fuck without lovemaking is the destruction, the degradation, right, of the phallus. It's the degradation of Yesod. Right? Fuck and lovemaking have to be two faces of the one. And with quivering fierceness, you need quivering tenderness. And any dissociation of them is actually what the Kabbalists would call kitzutz banetiot. You've cut off the root, would be the word
cut
for it.
The root. Cut right? off the root.
And, yeah. Right. And we'll talk about that next time. But maybe just the very last point to make here is that we have to learn to redignify the phallic thrust, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's feminine desire or masculine desire. And if not, we get a planet drenched in shame. Mm-hmm. We get a planet drenched in shame. And actually, if you trace the root of the metacrisis, you'll trace the root of the metacrisis to AI, you know, 150 men who actually haven't worked out sexuality. One narrow vector, right, of accomplishment, right, who are actually not integrated, right?
They're just in their brains, they're not in their phallus, you know, something like that.
But I could give 50 examples of the metacrisis, which is the field of eros has been emptied, right? There's this sense of ennui and pain. I go to cover it up with pseudo eros, which means when I cover something up with pseudo eros, I'll just give you one example of pseudo eros, a horror movie,
mm-hmm.
right? A horror movie. And I'm sorry to object to horror movies, but I morally object. Horror movies are fucking pornography. They just are, right? When you go to a movie, right, to see someone, right, sawed in half, right, arms cut off, and you're like, ah, because you feel you've been awakened by it. That is the pornographic universe, to be clear, right? If I'm aroused by massive violence that imposes radical pain, right? And I'm interested not in kind of the caricature, right, of kind of caricatured violence, but I'm interested in actually seeing the pain and being aroused by someone else's suffering.
Well, isn't it that you're not aroused in a way? Like, you go to a horror movie because you're not really aroused.
You go to a horror movie.
I've seen horror images that have shocked me to the core and made me weep. But I've never seen a horror movie that really
well,
did that.
I go to a horror movie because I'm not awake. I'm not in my aliveness. So, for example, the Hebrew word for yirah, which means both consciousness and to be God awestruck, is also the word for God fearing fear. Right. So the word for being awesome, the word for awesome, I'm in the numinosity of the awesomeness. Right. Right. Is the same word as kind of fear, where my hair stands on the end, or I'm going to a horror movie and I have the sense of pseudo erotic aliveness because I'm like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? So it's not a genuine arousal. It's a pseudo erotic arousal in order to cover up the emptiness.
That's the whole thing, though, with Netflix, though, isn't it? It's not just horror movies. It's practically everything that's there.
Well, there's many, what you're pointing out to is there's many strategies to cover up the emptiness. And one of them is what we might call kind of the warm comfort strategy. Yeah. Right? So you binge
sentimentality or
there's a warm, you just keep watching and watching and watching. And it's, you know, I don't know how many of you remember, but I'm sure in Europe and Holland or in Belgium, there's similar, but in France, you hit like 11:45. You know, I remember when I was 8 years old and, you know, the NBC, that bird would come on, right? And the Star Spangled Banner would play, right? Right. Who remembers, right? And then the freaking TV goes off, right? You know what I mean? It's off. And then there's this new thing. Oh, there's this late movie, right? There's like
one late movie.
And you see Spartacus again and again. Blue and again.
Movies, they're called.
Right? You're like, we're going to see Spartacus again, right? The Guns of Navarone. Let's see that again, right? You know what I mean? Reruns of Gunsmoke, right? This is exciting. Right? But basically, you turned it off. You turned it off because you have to go to sleep, right? So there's this comfort pseudo eros. Netflix is always playing 24 hours a day, which trust me. The destruction of the pseudo eros of comfort Netflix to people's sleep schedules is unimaginable. And then there's the other kind of pseudo eros, which we're actually overcoming the emptiness, and we do it with horror movies or we do it with the pornographic universe.
Yeah.
But the pornographic universe, right? And in general, even the I'm watching Netflix for the comfort eros, you might think that's kind of harmless. It's not, because I lose touch with my directionality. I lose touch with my phallus. I lose touch with the soad. And then I'm shamed by losing touch with Yesod. So the planet dredged in shame creates the pseudo eros that we fill up with win-lose metrics. We fill up with races to the bottom. We fill up with demonic versions of jihad that are not about internal struggle and transformation, which is the beauty of Islam, but they're about torturing the other who's outside of my inner circle. And so we create every manner of ethnocentric polarized pseudo eros, which is the core of the meta crisis. So we have to heal shame, and we can only heal shame, with all due respect to B'nai Brown. Sorry, B'nai, right? She does a really good job at the first level of shame. Tell the story of your shame, which is great. But actually, that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. You got to go much, much deeper. And in the end, you need to actually articulate a new narrative of reality grounded in the field of value and the tree of life, right? Through whatever tradition, right? Right. That actually, right, revivifies, right, the human experience as an experience of value, an experience of direction, in which my unique direction, because my unique self is my phallus and my yoni, right? We're going to do a whole unique self course in the fall, but my unique self is both the thrusting forward of my phallus, my unique thrust, and it's my unique yoni receiving reality thrusting forward. So my unique self fucks reality open, and then my unique yoni, right? My unique self phallus fucks reality open. My unique self yoni receives reality fucking me open, and I surrender. That's why we want to surrender. We want to surrender not because we want some idiot to dominate us, right? Right? We want to surrender because we're surrendering to reality. We're saying, take me. I surrender. I just am the quivering uniqueness of my desire. It's like, wow. Wow, we did. Wow. Andrew. Oh my God, right? Brother,
I think that was an important conversation. I hope lots of people hear it.
Yeah,
it was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Mark and Andrew. Amazing.
Amazing.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everyone.
And next time, without being too masculine and thrusting, but next time,
you're pushing me to play a song. Okay,
we begin with Andrew playing. Oh my God, it was a delight, everyone. Thank you. Crazy. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Gorgeous night.